You're listening to Cinema Red Pill. I'm Sharon, and today I have two guests, Charity and Raldi. Raldi's first time, Charity's third time. Yeah, but still introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. Charity, and I'm a visual artist in Kampala.
Hi, everyone. I'm Raldi, and I am a curator and artist in Kampala.
Yay. Okay. So on this episode, Charity and Raldi have joined me to talk about Savior Complex, the HBO documentary that came out in September 2023. And yeah, it's a doc, it's a true crime doc about Serving His Children, a nonprofit organization founded by Rene Bach. Yeah, there's allegations that rose up about her treating sick children without medical qualification, and it resulted into the death of the children. Before we start, I really wanted us to talk about the perception that the reaction people had when they saw the trailer. Because that was like the first time anybody heard about it, and it got such a strong reaction from people on social media. Like, how was it for you guys when you saw the trailer? And what did you think of people's reaction? Because I think that has led several people to not watch it. Some thoughts on that.
Actually, I knew about the documentary before it happened, but I kind of forgot about it. So when I saw the trailer, I was like, it's about damn time. We've been waiting this for a while. And I was just incredibly curious because I only knew like part of the story. I was really excited to like get the full picture and to also see how HBO would handle this topic, because it's a very, just as Africans, we felt some injustice in the way we're portrayed. So I was like, I'm really keen on like watching this critically. So yeah.
For me, this was like there were a series of complicated feelings about it coming out, because I, first of all, it happened in Jinja, which is my hometown, and I knew this lady in passing. In passing, you know, when I would work these small jobs during the holidays at university, some of them would be with some organizations that are sort of like linked to her organization, or they would give support in some way, and health organizations that would give support in some way to them, like giving trainings about, you know, nutrition or things like that. And I was just working as an intern, and we kind of, I knew there was a schism in the missionary NGO society, and I knew about what that looked like. And I knew about how the case was going with her. And also, I worked on this film. I worked on this film as a researcher, together with another journalist, who is British, and I worked as someone who we worked together. It had been a long time since I'd actually thought about this documentary.
Oh, what year was that when you were doing the research?
This was during COVID, the very first one.
Yes.
What?
The very first
lockdown. We were on lockdown actually in the same house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
And this was the very first. You would go off on research stuff in Jinja and come back. But then you couldn't talk about it.
We couldn't talk about it.
Oh, and so,
NDA locked thing. You know, they locked us in. So there's things I cannot talk about.
Wow.
But still, there's like a lot in the
document.
There's a lot to be said.
Yeah.
And I thought I knew what the whole... I knew specifically things around Rene.
Mm.
But there's so much more in the documentary that... They kind of, like, it's like a string that you just keep pulling, and so many unanswered questions. And going through the process of doing the research and then seeing the final product, there's also a lot of, I was very anxious. And I think why people were really ticked off was this idea that, you know, if you're going to tell a story about this thing happening in Uganda, how are you presenting the Ugandans? Are you actually telling their stories?
Mm.
And that was something we went in as researchers, really at the very forefront. Like, we needed to tell the stories of families.
Mm.
Who are these families? Where do they come from?
Mm.
Who are these women? Who are these children?
Mm.
And how are they coming to this place, and how is this happening? And for years, there had been a lot of discussions about Renee Back.
Mm.
But who are these Ugandans who have this case against her?
Yeah.
And honestly, it was so hard.
Yeah.
It was so hard to get those stories because...
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll talk about it.
Okay. I did not know about the doc happening at all. I had seen there's a documentary that NBS made. I'm not sure if it did. They had like an NBS investigate. I'd seen that. I'd read the articles about her. Had followed, of course, Norway Saviors and their reaction towards her, which is a whole thing. But when the trailer came out, I even failed to watch it because I was so... I got from people's reactions and from what made the eyes, it seemed to be a doc that solely focused on her, and that irked me. Like, I'm like, I don't want to look at this woman. You know, much anger of like, what? I don't want to see her.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I felt about it.
Yeah.
And then I actually, when it premiered, there was no buzz about it after that. Like, it kind of, like, people reacted to the trailer and stopped there.
Yeah.
But I saw some reviews and from critics that I like who are black and brown, and I liked what I read, what they said. They're like, it's a really broad thing. It contextualizes everything. So that allowed me to then give the doc a chance, and the doc shocked me because it does a lot.
It does.
It does a lot, and... Yeah, it adds so much. Even like seeing her, it just then was like, oh, she's not okay. You know, like this is fascinating to really watch her speak and believe certain things.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was turned out to be a fascinating documentary.
Mm.
But I think for some people, they would still not want to watch it.
Yeah, which is a shame.
Yeah.
I think it's a documentary that everyone should watch because it's not just about Renee.
Mm.
It aims to really speak about, that's why it's titled Savior Complex. It aims to speak about that she's not the only perpetrator.
Yeah.
It's as you know, anyone who is white and all of us who are sometimes we suffer the repercussions of what white ideas, white psyches, white religion, all this stuff, like we suffer from it sometimes, or we afflicted in it, or we participate in it. We all need to watch it because we need, it's a very important thing that needs to be just addressed.
Mm. And you really see that in the relationships, in the people around her, especially the Ugandans, the people who she worked with, the people who she... had schisms with. You could really see, and the doctor from the children's hospital, and the way he was speaking about how, you know, no one is going to give me that money, which is why I have to work with her. Like those relationships are really, they are why these children died. Why she was able to get away with this, you know, pretending to be a doctor, basically.
Yeah, let's get into it now.
Yeah.
Ready.
What were your reactions to the dog? And we can have just a general sporadic random discussion, really, but Raul, they want to hear from you first.
Do it.
I was both pleasantly surprised and a little disappointed. It was really mixed. I liked how they contextualized this thing happening in Jinja, and I liked that that they did not shy back from kind of talking about how complicated that the NGO missionary complex industry is just very complicated, and it's like the wild, wild west. They really gave it the kind of form that it is when you're in there. And I enjoyed the later episode because they brought in the families. They started bringing in the moms who had lost their children.
Yeah. The first episode is so heavy on her. And I think it can really turn you off.
When they started bringing in the mothers, it started kind of forming, and I was like, yes, that is exactly what I want to see. I thought there would have been more, because there were a lot more. There were a lot more families. But I think it's because I think they focused on those mothers because of the court case, and that they settled the court case. And that means there was like a legal... they could say this could be proved. Because she settled in court, so that means there's like a culpability there. But the other families, we saw so many families whose kids had died, but they could not prove. But from what they tell you, like, oh, that was messed up, what they did to your child. The details of it, it was clear that there was something done to these children, or there was a lack of care given to these children, in the way that the mothers described the situations leading up to their children dying. So yeah, I would have loved to have seen that, but I guess it would have maybe been too open-ended to kind of just say it's an allegation without proof. So I understand, but there were so many interesting families that we visited in remote places, and so it wasn't just Jinja. Went all the way up to the border of Kenya. So at some point we're going all the way like Malaba, and then
By the time you investigated, had this other through line of the third episode about the No White Saviors thing happened yet?
It was in the process of happening.
It was, yeah.
When that, the way that was showed in the documentary, honestly.
I actually feel like it helped complete the story, because I think there's something to also be said about not just focusing on Renee Back as a villain, but or as just this person with a problematic white savior kind of complex, but also to look at the dynamics of the institution which brought this case to light, and how even if you think you're on the right side, you can still perpetrate some kind of injustice with your whiteness or within the way the organization is being run. So I thought it was, I think maybe perhaps they delayed in making it because this other part of the story was also unfinished.
Yeah, I need to contextualize that part.
Yes,
actually,
please do.
The doc starts about talking about Renee, and No White Saviors was one of the organizations that really exposed her. Why? That's how I ever heard about her, because the page on Instagram would really post about her. And No White Saviors was she the director or co-director?
Co-founder. The three founders.
The three founders.
Olivia.
I forget the other one's name.
Olivia, Kelsey and not Jackie. Jackie was the other white lady.
Was it one white lady, then two Ugandans?
Yes. One white lady, then two Ugandans.
So then it was sometime later, Noah Saviors, the lady had an issue. Not had an issue. She was using money.
She was using funds.
For personal gain. And then she also had a spat with Olivia, which was very publicized. Like Kelsey herself then got exposed, and she had an incident where she was screaming at someone, like in a restaurant. That video really traveled on Twitter a lot. It was exposed, and Olivia then fundraised for the organization by herself and has taken over as the one who's leading it without Kelsey anymore. And Kelsey left. Was she already gone, or she left that country?
I think she had to leave the country.
And the biggest critique there to that organization was, how can you have a white person spearheading this thing when it's called No White Saviors? Basically, there's the contradiction there. So I'm happy that in the documentary they kind of also included that story within the greater story, because it was a very important thing to kind of note on again on this theme of what is white saviorism, what does it look like?
Mm.
Yeah.
What did you think of that through line? Were you shocked by it?
I expected it. Mm. We didn't get to actually speak as researchers. We didn't get to speak with Kelsey and Olivia. I think they wanted to just have a direct through line to the to the documentary producers.
Mm.
So they were kind of like out of it. And at that time, there was already that tension. So we were not a part of kind of getting information from them. But yeah, it was that chaos or in No White Saviors was kind of permeating through the entire process of making the documentary. It was very clear that there was already the just rifts happening left and right. The same thing that was happening happened to Renee was kind of mimicking itself in No White Saviors at the same time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was really interesting to see though, especially in the aftermath.
It was messy.
That was really messy.
Messy. And for anyone who's interested in that messiness, everything is on Twitter.
It was all out
in the open.
Which I think is much better than what was happening with Renee, because with Renee, she was very much protected.
Yes.
You know, her board was protecting her. Her board, aka
her mother,
parents. Her mother, who's
the
president of Ogun, was protecting her.
Yes.
And then when they left, it took blood and sweat to get her to into court.
Yeah.
And even then, she couldn't come. Like, she refused to come into the country. She was
to the country. Yeah.
Zooming in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To your thoughts.
I was really angry when I watched the movie. I was so angry. I think it like tapped into my general anger, towards injustice. And I think what made me most angry was I feel like the punishment did not fit the crime. I feel like what made me most angry was that Renee is still, like, she's still living her life. I'm like, even though these women got money,
mm-hmm.
and while that is, that money will help change their lives, according to Ugandan standards, because they probably would never have been able to get that much money, you know, unless something wildly happened in their lives that was, you know, giving them that money. It does help, but the impact of her actions is so deeply felt that I was like, she should be in jail. She does not deserve to be walking free, because that is not okay. Like, it's just, I was angry that, you know, she got away with so much, but I also understand that, you know, as Africans, this is how we are viewed as, like, we are not valued as human beings. So when someone does something outrageous like that, like, you know, it happened, it's not just Renee, it's many white people who have come and done egregious things since colonialism, and then they go back and then they just move on with life, because, you know, like, that's what happens. So it made me very angry, and it also made me very angry at the Ugandan government. But it also made me sad, because, you know, we still have so much to do for ourselves. So I think it was all those emotions together.
Another thing that also kind of really ticked me off was the how the Christian community will enable this to happen and protect and make this happen over when that lady who used to work for Renee, Constance, Nurse Constance, when she says that line, let whoever hasn't seen, let them cast the first stone at Renee. That kind of mindset.
Yeah.
It was very, the way she said it,
mm-hmm.
you know, you could, I'm like, you saw these things happening.
Yeah.
And I know you think, you know, because we fed so many children and cared for them, it still gives them them this mm-hmm. that sort of like carte blanche to do anything and get away with it and not have to be accountable.
Yeah.
A certain sense of a lack of accountability because these people are white Christian missionaries specifically. Mm. You know?
Yeah.
A lot of the cases that we have had of things like this is of children being abused in some way. It's like tourist men, you know, they're these sort of, but like when you think of a Christian white lady, they're always very protected, even by the same Africans who they're doing things.
Yes. It was troubling for me to also, you know, see that the Ugandans around her, like their number one excuse was the money.
We
have to survive. I'm like, but at the expense of your own, you know, people, like at the expense of children with the same skin color as you, like there's a kind of like a cutthroat, like survival mentality, which really scares me because, you know, when you're so worried about getting that money and you're not thinking about who it's hurting, like I feel like that ends up being always the same issue. And I think that that's where we tend to kind of get caught, because one of the reasons why these white people can do all that, it's like money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
true.
They bring money, and that could be your hustle, and I think that allows them to kind of do whatever the hell they want. So that really bothers me a lot in terms of, you know, having that accountability on our side as Ugandans. I'm like, come on, like, why, like, you know, they could have all whistleblowed her at some point. I was also surprised it was a white woman who ended up whistleblowing the whole, a Christian. Was she Catholic or something, or some kind
she
of...
She was like an old-timey missionary who had been there
for
a while.
And I was shocked because I was like, they whistleblowed? I thought it was a Ugandan, mama, or something. It was that one. I was like, wow. Which, to me, I kind of was happy about, but of course, I have very intense views about the presence of Christianity in Uganda, whether it's for good or whatever. I'm someone who was very much against it, but I was quite surprised. I was like, oh, okay, she did the right thing.
I think that really made me laugh in a sort of dark way.
Yeah,
was how they fundraise for their money and in the churches.
Oh yeah,
how she was doing it with these blogs, but also just the general missionary hysteria in the US.
It's really.
I was thinking about all these children whose photos are being taken.
Right?
You don't. Your photo is being showed up on a projector in
someone's church. If I can talk about my trauma, because I grew up in a white church, and I used to see those kinds of images, and also kind of had that experience of being the African person who they're saving within their space.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so for me, it's like a double, like, I don't know how to describe it, but it's something that I know so intimately, that like this white savior Christian like thing and how it's intertwined within Uganda and our culture and our history. I know it so intimately that actually there's something slightly cathartic about watching the movie, because I was like, this is something that really needs to be talked about. So like we've been talking about the people in Dubai, like the sex slavery that's happening and all these terrible things that happen to Ugandans who go out there and do cheyo or whatever, but we do not talk enough about white missionaries and the legacy of Christian colonialism in Uganda. We don't talk enough about it. It's really very harmful, I think, but also it's a conversation we need to have.
Yeah. I think also because it's America.
It's America.
You know, when people here think of going to America, it's like you're going for opportunity, but they don't realize sometimes when you're like a church, when you're in this missionary church thing, you're going there specifically as a what they call it, a physical manifestation of their need
to
come here.
Of their need to come, yes. Yeah.
You know?
Very much so. Oh my goodness.
That's a part that really, really stood out for me, which I felt like spoke so much more volume than even any of the talking heads, when Renee is operating on a really, really sick child, and then two of the nurses just look at each other. You know, they have this look of like, this white woman
this
taking
white woman.
Over.
Yeah.
Like, real pushing them aside to leave.
Yeah.
And they had this jaded look, which anyone will know when dealing with white people, and they just don't think you know what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm like, that face just was everything for me. I was like, yeah, these people are dealing with a lot. Why people? No. And that thing of just believing they know more than you. Oh yeah. My God. It's so annoying. But
yeah.
It's good to see those parts. I think they do. The doc does spend a lot more time than I would have wanted
mm-hmm.
on Renee. Like,
yeah.
True.
I hated that so much.
Mm.
So much time in her hometown.
Mm-hmm.
It gazes at her in a way that it's not as judged. And I thought about it because of, okay, the director is white, a white woman.
Mm-hmm.
She's putting the camera on another white woman.
Mm.
You always have your biases and those things come through.
Mm-hmm.
And it just takes way too much time on her.
Mm.
I think she's trying to let you decide, but that was too much time. I didn't need all that.
I mean,
yeah.
I think it was important because one thing that, I think for me personally, why I thought it was important, I mean, if it helped, they could have cut it down. But I think one really important thing about why white people do these kinds of things is when you start to investigate the white person themselves and like their context and their background, I think it's really important to give a full rounded image because it's I don't know how to explain it. It's kind of like, because I think
you have to investigate the sickness.
You can't just investigate. You can't just also look at them as like, this white person has done a bad thing. You really need to understand like why. And I think what was really important about Renee's story is this kind of very, when you look at the politics of America and how it like, how things, their culture is, it's very whitewashed that you're so white, you're in such a white world, you're so unexposed. And it's really quite shocking how, like, for example, she couldn't even pronounce the word colonialism.
Yeah.
She didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
She didn't, and I think that there's a huge danger in that because also this concept of this because these are the wars happening in America right now. They're like, let's not teach about racism in schools. And these are the kind of people like Renee who don't learn these things.
And
this
who's raising
this,
a black child.
And then they go and, yes, exactly. So stressful.
So,
yeah, it's very important. And to also see, like, I thought it was, she's also someone who is not, she's not filthy rich, but she's well off. Like, it's important to know that she's fine. Like, she did not need to come all the way to Africa. Like, it's really very much within their perfect little world and bubble of ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And because you see where she lives, there's no black people around her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that thing of her having to take her kid all the way to, you know, do her hair at some black person's, you know, like, there's something about this, like, perfect little world of hers that we kind of have to understand that she has absolutely, even in a multicultural America, whatever, she has no,
she basically lives in a snow globe.
She lives in a, thank you, that's the word I'm looking for. It's a snow globe. And I think it's important to understand that because people tend to, like, I think when people ask themselves, but how, why? And I'm like, it's because the very snow globe they're in is rarely
the
shaking.
Illness of it is...
It's already within that society. And I think that's the part, the place where, like, it needs to be combated. But, you know, it's hard to shake white people out of their, you know, their yeah, just
that, yeah, their white
own, their whiteness.
Mm.
It's hard.
True.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed the character who Jackie Atim.
That of Women Pro Bono Initiative.
No. The one who was working with Renee,
mm.
and she was doing she's a social worker.
Yes.
During the research, we met with her,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
honestly, that was one of the best people we spoke with,
mm-hmm.
Very hyper aware,
mm-hmm.
and I thought maybe that had happened in the aftermath of the case, but even listening to her interview in the documentary,
mm.
she was always very aware that this white lady had issues,
mm.
and her kind of taking accountability of, you know, these are women who I brought
mm.
to this organization and they're losing their kids. Like, that kind of understanding the depth and the responsibility of the work that they were doing.
Mm.
I think she really grasped that. And I really enjoyed her character arc.
Yeah.
generally, you know, kind of being that person with the eyes wide open, seeing everything for what it was. Her versus Constance, her versus the nurse, you know, it was very, very...
two opposing things. That was an interesting thing to see. Ginger, though. Like, Ginger is a place.
I actually really wish that they had... I mean, they kind of did in a way. But the Ginger as a character in itself, because there is so much there.
There's so much. The fact that people like to retire their white people, it's like being taken over.
It is taken over.
It's taken over.
Yeah, like the entire housing industry there has been dominated by... There's parts of Ginger where you cannot live as a Ugandan unless you make like 5 million shillings a month. All these like beautiful colonial homes,
reminiscent of colonial times.
If it isn't old families that have stayed there forever, it's white people and white missionaries and NGOs.
By the
There's
water.
Like streets that's just NGOs, and they're paying thousands of dollars, in rent, and they just keep driving the pricing up. So there's parts of town along the Nile, you know, it's illegal to buy land by the water. All that land, it's either like rich families from South Africa, Italian, or missionaries. It's crazy. But the town itself is just...
I remember, because this is how me and Gerald met, was in Jinja. And when I was living and working there, finally, for a white woman, and that's also how I kind of got to see into this missionary world. I remember having a conversation with someone at some place, and I remember them talking about... these white women were talking about how to fundraise and stay in Uganda, and I found that so strange. But I also specifically remember them mentioning going to a church service. And I had never heard of this church, but then I realized that there is like literally an all-white church in Jinja.
What?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Where there's like, you rarely see any black people there. It's only the white, so like all the white, and you won't even see these white people out and about in the market.
No.
You'll see like a glimpse maybe of a Mormon.
Nope.
But they are in their own world. They pray together. They hang out together. They raise their kids together. They don't even like mix with Ugandans.
They don't mix with Ugandans.
Don't.
The only Ugandans that mix with the people who they work,
yes,
who work for them.
Yes. So it's like it was a very bizarre thing. And even like, I remember the people who work for the white people, the Ugandans, you know, they can tell you stories. Like crazy stories, but you just know they also know all of these stories because the white people exchange, like if this one has to leave the country, they're like, oh, I'm leaving, but you know, so-and-so is such a great housemaid or they're
a nanny
keeper.
Or...
so let me, you can have them to work for you. Mm-hmm. And then like, you know, like that's how you know, like all the Ugandans who know these intimate things about these white people, it's because they keep working for the same white people, different ones, when they come and go. So I was like, this is very... it was just so bizarre for me. And Jinja is, like, as many of the towns in Uganda, like, the way it was built, you have, like, the white people built their nice houses tour by the water, these giant houses with lovely gardens. And then you have, like, the Indian houses, which are mostly abandoned, and then you have, like, the... Ugandan houses, like, or
Ugandans
as you spread out and go further. So believe me, the Jinja itself makes me sad because it is just gentrified in a sense. I don't know if that's the right word. It's gentrified.
It's gentrified for sure.
In a way, and the presence of white people is just so fucking bizarre for me and so disturbing. But also there's a kind of like, it's also quite quiet. Like you can never know about it. If you just go there to have a good time, it's only when you really
live there
and then you start to see, and they always have a project, whether it's always, and they always, they're like either knitting something, or they're making paper beads, or they're making bags, or they're opening up guest houses.
And that's the thing, is that they live in this very like almost luxurious life in Jinjatown.
Yeah.
And then they go out to the villages. That is where
their work is.
Oh my God.
So most times in the week, they're in the villages. They're doing their projects.
Yeah.
They're doing their reach outs.
Yeah.
And then they, you know, on the weekends, they come back and take the kids like to some
safari or
whatever.
Or some cute lodge.
Yeah.
And it's
they love Kapchora.
They love it's disturbing. And then there's this like, it's, I don't remember who was writing about this, but there's someone who talks about like when the colonialists came, they came with their wives and families,
mm-hmm.
and so the husbands would do like the work, like the government work, like they would be doctors or soldiers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, what do the wives do? Like, they have their own form of colonialism, which is kind of like they go to the women, you know, the women in the village, they teach them how to
be civilized.
To be proper civilized women.
Oh my God.
And that's it, it's so reflective still in the choice of things that they come and do here.
Mm.
Like, it's really reflective in what they decide to do when they arrive in Uganda, whether it's, you know, like they're like, let's start an Etsy store where you're making baskets and I'm selling them, and then those products, you know, when you see those products in Banana Boat or whatever, and it's always like empowering women to make baskets and to make jewelry and to make, you know, all this stuff. This is literally that culture.
Yeah.
Cool.
Whether it's handmade soap or whatever. And I remember this because the white lady we were working with, she was very much on that, like, she wanted like that big project, which is socially responsible, but she also wanted something where you could like make money, you know, because it does make money. Like, white people will be paying like $20-$50 for a necklace handmade by some poor woman.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time that money trickles back, it's really going to the person who's invested in the project, because they'll pay the Ugandan woman like $5,000 for that day.
Yeah.
But then they'll go sell this product.
Like,
and then
35,000 shillings.
And then they'll keep running the establishment. So there's also wealth generated in there.
Yeah.
So it's really like, it's just this, and they even talk about in the documentary of like the implications of like this colonialism, this religion colonialism, these women and all, like they talk about it, but I feel like it's still not been addressed.
No.
Mm.
We don't talk about it, but this is just neo-colonialism, honestly. It's it's really in this kind of potent, quiet, feminine kind of form.
I remember when 2010, when we worked for that white lady, there would be buses of
missionary tourists.
People in the high school,
uh-huh.
just graduated high school,
yeah.
and their parents, they
yeah.
come to Africa
uh-huh.
and to like visit this missionary church, and it's like three buses of white people just driving to the compound.
Yeah.
And they're like, and she introduces like, this is my project, and these are the people who are working for
me.
This is what we do. And then they buy stuff.
They buy stuff and they go
they
sell
buy
it.
Stuff, and then
you make,
know
they make bank.
They make,
like
white lady makes bank.
Yeah, white ladies make bank. There's this artist, I don't know if I'm rambling too much, but there's this artist, Sané Gatega.
Yes.
Yeah.
He makes his artwork with paper beads.
Mm.
And the way he hates, loathes these white women.
They've hijacked his completely.
Yes. It's not to say that paper beads weren't being made, like, you know, it's an old like craft form.
Mm-hmm.
But the way in which they come, they make bank on it, but then they kind of like cheapen it in a sense, because it's very much like they don't appreciate the craft because it's an art form. They kind of just use it as a sob story to get money.
Oh,
because the person who buys this paper bead might even think it's ugly as hell. They might buy this necklace and be like, this is ugly as hell, but it's going to a good cause. So you know, while he himself like uses the like he uses it in a collective form, so that means he's working with groups of women, he pays them, they make these beautiful works, and then he has the vision, but essentially it's a very collective art form.
Mm.
So there's a kind of like just, I guess, bastardization of the intention of what it's meant to do
mm.
when it's co-op, like it's taken up with these white women. So I think that's the,
that sounds like the director of the Children's Hospital what he was saying about when
yeah
she basically bastardized the whole child care.
Anyways,
that's true.
Just as a side note of this world, but yeah.
Masese specifically, I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's a fishing village just outside of Jinja, just outside of, on the other side of Jinja's industrial area. And it's a very poor place, but I remember as a kid going there and playing with these children. It's a very, it's by the water, so of course there's issues with that, like there's a lot of issues with landing sites generally. There's a lot of prostitution. There's a lot of people don't have land to make food, like to plant their own food, because people are basically living as squatters and around, and it's always very, very, very populated. But it was, for me as a kid, it was a fun place to just go. There's a very dark story of this mother and son duo from Canada.
What?
This is like 2009. Who they came when we were working for this white lady, and they homeschooled for sure. They basically probably live like in like the woods somewhere in Canada, and they decided to come this side because I think at that point like the NGO Christian thing was so huge and so unchecked. So it was much wilder back then. Things have kind of been curbed down a little. But yeah, they were running around Masese with like pockets filled with like bananas and sweets, just handing them out to children. And then the mother got a basin and she was like, "These children are dirty, let's wash them." And yeah, they had to call this white lady and tell her like, "These people are going to kill this white lady for touching these people's children."
Oh my
they had to pull out of Masese. It was so funny.
What?
That's so messy.
So messy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-mm.
But it was very much that place where weird things were always happening. So when Renee opened her thing there, I kind of understood like the kind of demographic that she was trying to reach out to and make this project around, because it's a very it's a very impoverished place.
For Jinja, I don't know what else to say. All I can say is just, damn, these white people. Like honestly, it needs to be checked. Honestly, it needs to be checked. And I think that the word carte blanche, like this thing of just letting them come and go and do whatever. It's too much. And even like in our like if you want to get a visa in Uganda, like it's so easy. Aside from the visitor's visa, it's, I think, one of the easiest visas to get is the it's under the religious like if you're in a religious institution. This is a very easy visa to get. So I think it's just too easy. It just needs to be something needs to be done. Yeah.
I hope these people revisit this documentary at some point.
Right?
And what, like continue it?
I think Renee is a good case point, I feel like. But I think
there's so many.
There's especially bigger fish to fry.
For
there's
sure.
Bigger fish than Renee.
I think so.
Yeah. Like we worked on the case of this German man who was abusing girls on the islands.
Oh,
he died.
German guy.
He died, but that story needs to be told because so many... I think he paid quite a lot of influencers in the media to like trash these girls. So even when he was taken to court, like a lot of the girls were being harassed. So I think this is one of those stories that also needs to be set straight, like for the sake of their like the social justice aspect of it. Like the man is dead, at least they took him to court, but in terms of like setting that narrative correct, and them getting some kind of like social justice in that sense, where
yeah.
society needs to acknowledge that they, that's a story. I mean, there was even one more recently in the news about this white couple that was abusing a child they adopted. Like, I mean, let's, I'm just going to say it, nyege, like, what, why don't we have one about them yet?
That
like,
would be an
what?
Interesting documentary.
Like, you know, it's we have so many stories of this particular dynamic.
Yeah. And also, like, on a very, like, high, even political level, maybe that might be harder, but I think it's important.
Yeah.
All these, like, lobbying organizations from
yes,
the U.S.
from the U.S.
that are very, like, right-wing Christian evangelical.
Yes.
Yes.
Those people.
Yes. Big time.
I think these missionaries are able to get away with this kind of thing because these organizations are there.
Yeah.
That man who was representing Renee, that lawyer, he is very much linked to these huge organizations. That, you know, lobby political people here.
Yes.
So like that dynamic also needs I think.
Yeah.
And just generally their influence and also what happens in Uganda politically.
Mm.
It needs to really be it needs to be addressed.
Yeah, there's that documentary called God Loves Uganda. Have you guys watched it?
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah, that one covers it a bit.
Very,
There's a Netflix doc that gets into Cornerstone, that one of those evangelical places. And they mention Uganda and David Bahati.
Yeah.
Their
really
office is on...
Yeah.
Is on... what's it called?
Acacia
Avenue. Acacia Avenue. Yes. I'm like, these are the people.
It's so disturbing because there's this channel I love watching this because they talk about religious fundamentalism.
Mm.
It's called Fundy Fridays, and I was so disturbed. I watched all their videos, like over time I've watched every video they've made. The amount of times Uganda comes up, guys, it's disturbing. They do quote God Loves with you Uganda, but then there was this whole episode about this white man who was telling Ugandans to drink bleach.
What?
To cure HIV. Yes.
Oh my God.
He came.
No.
Guys, it's legit for real. Like, it's real. I was just disturbed. I was like, the amount of times Uganda comes up, the amount of times it was some crazy, you know, religious person who's like, has their own idea of what to do and how they should do it. And maybe they get found out in the US, so they don't know anywhere else to go. Where do they come?
Here.
Yeah. Because it's that easy to just come and, like, you know, convince some other poor people who need, you know, some kind of something from you, and or if they don't need it, but they kind of see that you can provide it for them, and just be manipulative and do fucked up shit. So, yeah, that's I was like, wow, this is very dark, but yeah.
Mm. Yeah, there's that thing of like the people. There's someone who was talking about how it's still a little problematic that a lot of the work that's done exposing the white people is by white people, because it's also like, are you investigating yourself? Like,
that was a question I had in my head watching it. If how, you know, like the position that the documentary directors and producers kind of what position were they like, did they put themselves in? And did they question that?
Just even being in her presence and just being okay with it. I don't know, like there's
a divisive thing that's happening in the US, which again, to talk about the thing of why they spend so much time on Renee, that really bothers me. It's this like this thing of, you know, listen to both sides. And I'm like, I feel like it's like the new way of saying that we don't want to believe that, like, this person who's doing a bad thing is doing a bad thing, but the only way we can excuse their rhetoric, their ideas, and their whatever is to claim this thing of they're not being heard. And that was the thing that really bothered me about Renee Back, is that she went on Fox News, which is like the most divisive, like CNN and all these, they have their issues, but this is the most divisive channel with a very huge alt-right following, Christian, white, like just very, and I think in a sense they just came to her aid, and already that narrative began of, she's not the bad guy. So I think it might have also been a bit important for HBO to stamp out this claim if they released the documentary, that they did not you know, like they just villainized her. I think it was important for them to be like, no, we're giving a whole, you know, 360 view of her. So that way she doesn't feel like we've silenced her in some form, because then it would be an unjust perspective on her. And I feel like that again ends up having to cater to the oppressor or to the bad person.
Mm.
And I feel like that's the thing that's really bothers me right now within their whole psyche. It's like someone can go on air and say really anti-Semitic, really horrible things, or anti whatever, like just racist stuff. And then when you call them out, they're like, well, that's freedom of speech. I have a right to say this. This is my perspective. You know, like, I have to be heard out. And I'm like, you're also just spewing hatred, like, period.
Yeah.
You're excusing it. And I feel like people get really into that trap. And it bothers me so much. It pisses me off when I hear, like, people are like, yeah, you have to hear it both sides. And I'm like, but one is clearly just damaging others.
I wonder, though, how effective it would be for, you know, if the film maker, if the documentary maker is a black person,
true,
how effective it would be.
Yeah.
It would definitely be different, though.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think so. Mm. It would be different. Because I think white people, generally, because a lot of media is really created from their perspective.
Mm.
So people go into it kind of with that already set up.
Yeah.
So having, have being interviewed by black people,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if she'd have even agreed to it.
Listen,
I mean, there
were
so many things, which I was also surprised in the documentary, the amount of things she agreed to do.
That's what I'm meaning. Right? The way her mom spoke, and then when receipts would be pulled out, and her mom was like,
the way she was throwing those people under the bus, and then they brought out the receipts, and then they're like, so and so was actually not there that day. And she was like, oh, they weren't? Oh. And you could just see her, like, just, you know, just lies, and, you know, like, her just, they caught that perfect expression of
they really
lie
that,
on her feet, lying. So that is a great question to ask. Would she have been so compliant if it was black people? You know,
yeah, because
probably, I don't think so.
Towards the end, she was clearly, I don't know in what sequence they filmed in, but at some point you could see that she was like, oh, I've been caught in a way where, you know, I can't answer that question.
Yeah.
She just wouldn't engage. But before, she was like saying so many things.
Mm. And I think it's fascinating that, one of the things that I found really interesting about her is the way in which she spoke so honestly,
mm-hmm.
as she truly believed that she's being persecuted.
Mm-hmm.
Like she's the victim
mm-hmm.
in the whole entire story. And I really found that very interesting, because it actually made her so honest
mm-hmm.
that for us who are, like, I feel like they did not have to do a whole lot to, like, get the truth out of her, because she was just so honest. She was like, I'm a good person, and I'm being persecuted, and this is exactly what happened, and you know, and she couldn't actually deny so many things. And I think it wasn't until they kind of, like, put those things in perspective for her that she realized, like, oh fuck.
Mm-hmm.
And because she was even like, she was blaming the public or the audience or Ugandans or whoever persecuted her. She's like, my child is so sad. They can never go back to their home. I'm like, no, your child can go back to her home.
You can go back.
Yeah. But you're going to insist on keeping this child, because, I mean, it's not her fault. Who else does she know? She knows you.
Mm.
But I was like, she was like, yeah, it's like these people are so terrible. They forced me, they forced my child out of her home. She can never go back to her. And I'm like, how in the world is this any of her fault?
Yeah.
This is all you. Mm. But she, you know, she really failed to see her own culpability in the whole entire story.
That's what, you know, that evangelical Christian mindset is.
Mm.
Is that, you know, you are God's person,
mm-hmm.
and no weapon formed against you shall prosper.
Oh my god!
I want to talk about this, because it was so, the scenes where you see her in her church, or you see, like, the church prayer and all of that. this, I cannot tell you how much this happens in America. And like, it's so normal for them to just, the way this mindset is and like the way this culture is of like, you know, we're gonna go to Africa, and then they come back with their sob stories and they cry and they're like, these people, they are suffering, and you know, and it's so compelling for them, because they also feel like they're doing something good and that they're saving the world, you know, and it's just such a, it's so sinister, and it's so crazy when I think about that. I used to see this almost like every Sunday, and it just it's so sinister. And I remember, just to share one thing with you, is our pastor, nice man, but I remember him preaching one time, because he comes sometimes once in a while. They've built churches in Rwanda and stuff like that. So like our reverend, he one time was preaching, and I just remember thinking it was odd. But of course, when you're young, you're like, whatever. I remember him preaching. He was like, you know, he's like, telling his congregation of mostly white people, he's like, you guys don't understand spirituality. You don't understand faith. And he's like, I've been to Uganda. They have almost nothing, but they have faith. You know, like they really believe in God, and they wake up every day and God is in their hearts. And I was just like, like in my mind, I was like, wait, what? Like, what? And then, but it's that, like, and he was a really nice person, because he really supported my family. Like, you know, we like with money, with just being able to go there, like he hosted us. But then the mentality.
It's so sinister.
Yeah. You're just a representation of something else.
And he really thought he was inspiring his congregation to be like, you know, you have everything.
But that's the thing. Like, they will, for them, their relationship with faith is based on, you know, like motions, because nothing really bad has happened to them.
Nothing has really shaken their reality.
They are white. They're going to be fine.
You know,
and most of these families, like their wealth just keeps going. Even if it's like middle class wealth,
it stays the same. You have a very comfortable life.
They live well into their 80s. You know, for us, we have had so much more. So then when they see that, for them, you know, there's this song where this lady says, she's going, you know, like she's going through these feelings, and she's feeling crazy and having all these feelings with the conviction of someone who nothing really bad has ever happened to, but very dedicated to the feeling. It's like very performative. You know what I mean? Very performative, not knowing the actual tangible feeling of having your faith checked or going through trials and tribulations. So it's, it's like they want that kind, like they want that blackness in them, but they don't want the actual trouble you go through.
The trouble you have to go through.
To build faith.
Yeah, exactly.
They want the faith without the valley of death.
That is a fantastic way to put it. There is no testing of their faith.
Yeah.
They have no reason to, they have no struggle, really. I don't want to say that they don't all struggle, but in terms of like what can make your spirituality strengthened or whatever.
I mean, when you're having to deal with like real, when you're having to deal with death, when you're having to deal with
poverty
and like your spirit is being killed by so many things,
and all forms of oppression,
so many forms of oppression as black people, you know, we then build that, but for them, they don't know anything.
They don't know that. So true.
They want that thing because it looks good.
It will look good
on their wall. Then maybe it would make them worthy of all the things.
How many black kids' pictures are on white people's walls? That's another. I actually have to say that the thing that was shocking for me was her blog posts, and
those
her
were unhinged.
Those were. Unhinged, and the footage there was this, it was, I don't remember, it was the second episode, I think, where the young man who went as a volunteer, and he was taking footage because they needed it for promotional stuff.
Yeah.
The content he captured. I was even, I had a whole debate with Timothy. I was like, how did they get a hold of that footage? It was so incriminating.
Yeah.
We're like, did she just handle it over freely? Did the guy have it and hand it over to HBO?
It was probably on her website.
Because it was
the way
so, to... like, that...
I wouldn't be surprised.
That when you were talking about that look those women gave each other, when that was him. That was him capturing all those moments. That hit her, like, putting thingies in the baby's hands and, like, you know, it was really quite bizarre to watch, and how, like, she also felt no shame. Like, no one... like, I just... It really... was super disturbing, just how, like, her honesty, you know, it's coming from this place of, like, I can do no wrong. But she's just, like, technically writing herself out, you know? Like, she's not trying to conceal anything. And I think, in a sense, that was kind of a helpful thing, because otherwise it would have been very hard to, like, get her on some of these things.
Yeah.
But the blog post, I was like... But then also the disturbing thing was the people who read it and were so enthralled.
Yeah.
They were like, wow, she's really... You know, again, that thing you're talking about, that they want that thing that they can't have, so they're, like, reading her blog post, and they're like, wow, she's really living this life where she's doing this amazing thing. And
changing.
Changing the world, and she's so closer to God, and, you know? Like, and I was just like, this is so sick. You are reading about a white woman practicing medicine.
A homeschooled... This just got out of high school. She only has a high school degree.
Yes. And I don't know if I'm confusing this with something else I watched, or it was in the documentary, but there was, like, some kind of training, medical training.
Yes.
But it was very brief. It was
like a class of something.
Some class.
And I was like, excuse me?
That's a big qualification.
This makes me think of another documentary. There's a DW, they have been doing a really great job with us. Recently, they have these short documentaries, and they did one about these older German pensioner people traveling to a specific town in Thailand, where they basically get, like, Thai wives. It's basically, like, you know, like, legalized. It's not legal, but it's just widespread prostitution.
Oh.
But they don't call it that. And how deluded these men were, you know, when the interviewer would ask them, so you're paying these women to have a good time with you, and these women are sitting next to the man, like, just so, yeah, you're paying these women to have a good time with you, and it's not prostitution. It's not prostitution. I mean, we have an arrangement, but it's not prostitution. Like, that it's important, you know, like, the wires are not connecting. The wires are not connecting at all.
What do they call it? Cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, the cognitive dissonance is just...
something is not clicking.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's crazy.
Justification, I guess, of that immoral or, you know, reprehensible behavior. Yeah.
You have to make yourself
believe you're not the bad person.
Yeah, otherwise you won't be able to live with yourself. Before we close, Raul, do you have nothing else? And there's nothing we've missed that you've written?
No, I wrote down notes. No, I think I would really recommend that people watch this documentary.
Same.
Three chapters, each is kind of like a block, kind of covering different things in the story. But it was a great reminder that, you know, there are all these gaps that people are taking advantage of in this country, and they're enabled by so many people, including some people in our own, you know, by Ugandans also. Show it to your families. I think it's a documentary that should be really watched by a lot of people who are having children in Uganda. It should be in Bibandas.
Yeah, I did not know about the heavy, horrible issue we have about malnutrition in Uganda. I learned that.
Mm.
That for me was very sad because I just didn't know enough about it. And I also, it's one of those issues that I'm like, I thought in my mind, like, we are not having these problems anymore, but we really do.
We do, yeah.
I think Gerald one time said something about, like, how, yes, Renee did what she did, she played her part, but then he was like, but also the other people to blame are the ones who make it give her fertile ground to exploit, which was one, the government, and then I think you said also the people who were working with her.
Yeah.
So for the government, I was disturbed in the documentary that she was shut down before she left the country. She was shut down 2-3 times, but then within a month or 3 months, she would be open,
pop up
again. And I think without directly saying it, if you're Ugandan, you'll understand this, without directly saying it, the HBO people were trying to be like, how is she coming back so many times? She has money, she's bribing someone, someone is getting money out of it.
Yeah.
Because if the police shuts you down once, why are you doing it again? It shouldn't be so easy for you to do it again because they have your stuff on file, and if someone else complains, they'll find you again. But she was shut down several times. It's a breeding ground, really, for people to exploit. And I was just thinking about those things. I'm like, we really have to, you know, we have to do our parts, you know, as Ugandans, we have to do our part. But also, I know with government, it's a tough one, but, you know, hopefully that will change one day. But I think also, we really have to, it's important to watch this movie because I think it's important to understand that, you know, these are like the echoes or repercussions of what colonialism has done. They talk about it in the first episode about the history of colonialism in Uganda and the impacts of religion. And I'm like, we are still feeling these effects, but we are the ones who have to like mitigate or stop them. Otherwise, they just continue. Like, we have to, and I think that was the very important thing that happened with the No White Saviors part. We also can't just be identifying like white saviors as solely in the ones who do obviously bad things. There could also be white people who are doing seemingly good things, or they seem to be on the right side, the right side of the fight. But because of the inherent way in which white identity has kind of been formed around, you know, oppressing others, it's really hard for them to check themselves, is basically what I could say. It's very hard for white people to, because they don't know any better sometimes, because that's how they were raised, that's what they were taught, and it's really hard to like deconstruct yourself to that point where you can be aware that you're doing harmful things to other people. So I think the documentary is really important to watch because it reminds us that we have to check these people. It's not just about, you know, like just being like, oh, they did this terrible, we have to check them, we have to be like, you have to hold them responsible, you have to remind them that our lives are of value, you have to remind them that we are human beings, we deserve respect, we deserve, you know, you have to hold them accountable for what they're doing, otherwise they'll just keep doing it. And I think that that's why people should really watch it, and they should know this story, because if they ever see anybody else in this kind of situation, they have to talk about it. We can't be waiting for also the white people to be the ones who are the whistleblowers and save us again in some sense.
It's so not just it's a white problem. It's a white problem that is affecting us. So we need to be very aware.
Yeah. Yes. So
beautifully said.
But also, I think it's also like a great documentary, just in general.
Just
great,
as a doc itself, it's
really,
well made.
It's really well made.
Yeah, good story.
I also like that they highlight, sorry to go back, but they really highlighted some certain critical black voices. Rosebel was in there. That was really great to see. And then the pro bono,
the lawyer.
I love the lawyer.
She was amazing.
So much. She was one of my
amazing
favorites.
I just want to see that organization.
I know where it's located. I just look at it like, you can
she's
great.
Incredible.
They need support. They need more.
I really loved
doing good work.
How clear-headed she was in the whole entire process.
Yeah.
She did not allow, and I think this sometimes can happen, she did not allow for anyone on either end to like sway her, because like the way when was it Kelsey, the one of No White Saviors, was like taking pictures of these kids and posting them. When she told the lawyer, she ruined this girl's life. But she's like, actually, no, the mother was thankful. Mm-hmm. But then she was like, no, she ruined her life. Look at her face. It's all messed up. And, you know, like she talked about how Kelsey was also not really listening.
So
I loved how clear-headed she was, because she also did not get, pulled in a direction. She was like, if I get pulled in this direction of sensationalizing, it could actually hurt the case.
Yeah.
So when she came to talking to Renee also, and the points they kept trying to make, she was like, listen, at the end of the day, you operated without a license, with no medical training. So even if we can conclude that you killed this child or this child, did was so illegal.
Yeah.
In your own country, no one would ever accept this, but you did it here.
Mm.
And I think even that white lawyer, when he was talking to her and he was like, I think you just have to let this one go. And then she was like, I really didn't think I was guilty. And it's like, no, ma'am, you are guilty. And that's something you have to accept.
Yeah.
You have to accept that you operated in a country, you're not a doctor, you don't have a license, and that's just coming down to the facts of it. And that's something that she'll have to live with for the rest of her life. And I think that if that lawyer had not been so clear-headed and so, I don't think that that
Prima
justice
Bagala.
Would have...
That's
yeah,
that's
she's just brilliant. Brilliant.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, they really highlighted people other Ugandans, which was really good.
Yeah, who did the right thing.
Just
that
so really nice
happy.
To see my childhood hospital.
Oh.
Nalufenya Children's Hospital. That's where I got all my immunization jabs. That's where they used to take us. It's like very close to where I grew up.
Oh.
We would just walk. You have a little malaria, they take you there.
Oh, yeah.
That's cute.
Yeah.
Very cute.
Nostalgia. Were you
very much.
In all that chaos.
You know?
Mm.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, guys. So much context. So much.
Yeah.
Addition to what the, even more than what the film is presenting there. So this has been a great conversation. Thank you, Charity. Thank you, Raldi.
Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you, Sharon.
Like you said, please watch that film as well.
Watch it.
Yeah, thanks. This was our episode on Savior Complex. I'm Sharon.
Charity.
And Raldi.
Bye.
People make films about themselves. What they want. What they love. What they fear most. Here we're nothing but props and their stories.
También say.